Support for WPR comes from the Stevens Point area, offering a variety of getaway experiences, itineraries and ideas for beer lovers, foodies, outdoor recreation fans, and more are at StevensPointArea.com.
It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Wisconsin Life, a look at a Wisconsin monastery's efforts to be more environmentally sustainable.
First, Wisconsin's voter ID law is in federal court in Milwaukee today. The American Civil Liberties Union is trying to expand the types of identification cards the state accepts for voting.
Ken Mayer is with us now to put the news in context. He's a professor of political science and affiliate faculty member of the La Follette Institute of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. Ken, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Well, one striking thing about this case in court today is what it does not do. This is not an attempt to block voter ID in Wisconsin anymore.
No, it isn't. This is what's called an as-applied challenge, unlike the earlier lawsuit, which attempted to throw the whole law out. This is making specific claims about the effect of the law on particular populations and also is asking the judge to order some narrow specific relief as the law is implemented. So it's very different from the original lawsuit.
And what kinds of relief? As I understand it, it's expanding the kinds of ID a voter could use at the polls.
There are two types of relief that the lawsuit is asking for. The first is they are asking the judge to order that military veteran administration ID cards, technical college IDs, and out-of-state driver's licenses be permitted under the law as satisfying the conditions of the law. And they're also asking the judge to order that there be an indigency exception, so someone who claimed hardship or inability to obtain the underlying documents would be able to execute an affidavit at the polls. And the argument is that these would permit people who would otherwise be prevented from voting to actually cast ballots, and also is consistent with the purpose of the law.
That's been one of the arguments. The idea is, okay, you can go and get a state ID for free, but as I understand it, you need a birth certificate to do that. That's not free. So that's been one of the arguments that people shouldn't have to pay?
Not quite. The argument is a little different. It's saying I suppose you're right that for some people who are unable to obtain their documents, the birth certificate, and some of the plaintiffs actually didn't have a record of their birth. But probably more people would be affected by the out-of-state driver's license. So currently under the law, if you are a student or a snowbird who resides in the state and is actually eligible for voting under state law, in order to obtain a voter ID or a driver's license, you would actually have to surrender your out-of-state driver's license. And in the case of getting a Wisconsin driver's license, pay a fee. So the argument is that requiring people to give up their ability to drive or pay a fee is the constitutional problem here.
So the core of the ACLU's argument, it sounds like, is that, hey, there are some specific groups of people, potential voters in Wisconsin, who would be unduly affected by this law. We want this relief, they're saying, to balance the playing field?
That's essentially correct.
And what are we hearing from the Wisconsin Department of Justice? They're defending the law in federal court. How have they responded?
Well, I haven't seen anything about their response. I suspect their response would be the same as it was in the original lawsuit, that there is a valid governmental interest in preventing voter fraud, and the state legislature made these decisions and also ordered, I think they'll take notice of the fact that when the state Supreme Court considered the state challenge, the state Supreme Court ordered that the Department of Transportation allow for some exceptions for people who couldn't procure a birth certificate or didn't have the money that they could satisfy the underlying documentation requirements in other ways.
Talking to political scientist Ken Mayer from UW-Madison about a lawsuit in federal court today regarding Wisconsin's voter ID law. Not this time to throw it out, but to tweak it some, especially when it comes to the kinds of ID allowed at the polls. How is this a common thing? One objection I've seen out there is, hey, you're in effect asking the court to rewrite the law that the legislature passed. Is it common for courts to add that little level of nuance?
It is. The argument is not simply asking the court to change the law, but arguing that the law as it is being executed or implemented continues to violate the constitutional rights of people and that the relief that they're asking for is a way to remove those constitutional problems. And these kinds of initial facial challenges or direct assault on the law are very frequently followed up by what are called as-applied challenges that attack or go after specific implementation steps as the law is taken into effect. And a lot of these issues and questions are fairly technical.
The ACLU has made the case that our voter ID law here in Wisconsin is among the most restrictive in the nation. Is that, as you understand other states' laws, is that true?
Oh, it's absolutely correct. There are two reasons the law here is, if not the most restrictive, certainly among the most restrictive. The first is the limited forms of ID that comply with the law. You need a passport, a Wisconsin driver's license, a Wisconsin ID, certain kinds of college IDs, a tribal ID, very narrow range of identification. And the other is the lack of any safe harbor exception. So in Indiana, for example, and other states, if you go to the polls and you don't have an ID, you can sign an affidavit saying that you couldn't obtain one. A number of states don't apply the voter ID requirements to absentee ballots. Wisconsin does. You would have to include a photocopy of your ID. So I don't think there's any question that the law here is the strictest in the country.
Some of the previous challenges had included claims that the law would unfairly affect minority voters, in particular, sometimes elderly voters. Is that now not part of the argument in this newer case?
That's no longer part of the argument, because those were the claims that were made initially and that were ultimately the district court judge agreed and joined the law. The Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals overturned that, and the Supreme Court refused to hear the appeal. So those are off the table.
Are we unique in Wisconsin with this long process? This is 5 years in the making now before this thing will be used for a full year. Are similar things going on in other states?
There are other challenges that continue to work their way through the process in Texas and North Carolina. It hasn't really been that long, 3-4 years in the grand scheme of things with a constitutional challenge to a law like this is really not that long.
This challenge in federal court could be in place, I guess, if the court agrees with the ACLU, expands the amount of IDs. It could be in place for the 2016 elections at a time when our government accountability board could be subject to change by the legislature. Is this a big enough change that it would make the election more complicated?
Possibly. I mean, this is not going to be the last move in the process, because it's going to be a while before the judge issues a decision. Certainly, if he decides in favor of the ACLU, the state will appeal and it will go through the process. As it stands now, the law is in effect, and so the burden is on the plaintiffs here to win. If it's a draw, if the decision is not issued, the law remains in effect.
We're talking to political scientist Ken Mayer now about the news that Wisconsin's voter ID law is in federal court today.
We're continuing our conversation now with political scientist Ken Mayer about Wisconsin's voter ID law, which is in federal court today.
Taking your calls now, what do you think about the ACL's request to have more types of ID accepted at the voting stations? Are you worried about not being able to vote because of your type of ID or lack of same? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post over on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to a caller now. Marty is on the line in Woodstock. Marty, hi.
Good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call. It's my understanding that the percentage of voter fraud in Wisconsin is 0.0034, which roughly translates to 219 instances of potential voter fraud. And of that, it was learned that maybe 100 or so were people going to the wrong poll. Unless I have my numbers wrong, isn't this a solution looking for a problem? The same situation is occurring in Ohio.
Marty, thanks for the call. Ken, that's been the argument over this voter ID from opponents in particular, obviously, that this is not needed. There's not a whole lot of fraud that this would solve.
Well, the caller is absolutely right. And there is precisely zero evidence of any systematic voter fraud, particularly of the form that would be prevented by a voter ID. It just does not happen with any frequency that voters voters will show up at the polls impersonating someone else, and all of the stories of union people hurting their people through the polls, and dead people in Chicago voting, and story after story of hordes of illegal voters being shepherded through the polls, non-citizens voting. It just does not happen with any frequency. And when it does happen, it is almost always either an administrative error or someone who at one point was not a citizen, but they have since become naturalized, has voted, or, as the caller alluded to, people showing up at the wrong polling place and even administrative record-keeping errors. And so the idea that in-person voter fraud throws into question the legitimacy of elections, it is just flat out false. And study after study after study has shown that there is zero evidence of it. In fact, a colleague and I here, along with another professor at Stanford, did some surveys where we found that there are more people who say that they have been kidnapped by extraterrestrials than who say that they have actually voted in someone else's name. So in that sense, it very clearly is a solution in search of a non-existent problem.
Marty, thanks for the call. I'll go next to Spike in Milwaukee. Spike, hi.
Hi, how are you today?
Good. What do you think?
Well, I'm a chief inspector at two wards in Milwaukee. And first of all, the law itself is a joke. There's no good reason to have it. As the gentleman before me said, voter fraud is basically non-existent. But the thing is, since we have to have this law, we do need to have more forms of ID be accepted. I mean, even now in the registration process, the regular registration process, it wouldn't hurt to be able to accept more types of ID in order to get people registered. When they first started promoting this law, they said one of the reasons was because the people at the polls were so overworked. Well, that's not a horse hockey. We do our jobs. It can be a little tough sometimes, but we're proud to do it. We're honored to do it. And they never bothered to ask us if we felt we were overworked.
Spike, thanks a lot for the call. Ken, saying he didn't like the law in the first place, as somebody who works at polling stations, he likes the idea of expanding the number of IDs available.
Well, that would certainly solve one of the problems, because if you grant that it is necessary for people to verify their identity, I in fact do not. I think that there's no evidence that that's actually necessary. There's no reason to accept a much broader range of IDs. Some states allow any form of public identification, whether it's public assistance cards, state or federal employee identification, all kinds of things with picture IDs that would satisfy the requirement of verifying that the person presenting himself or herself at the polls is the person who's registering. I don't think there really is any question that these laws are specifically designed to make it harder to vote. And the impact that it has on disproportionately minority and disadvantaged populations, that has been shown time and again to be true, that it is the people at the margins who have the most difficult time obtaining one of these forms of ID are the least likely to possess them. I think it is a fair characterization to say that these are really a thinly veiled voter suppression law, and I don't think that's an unfair characterization.
Back to our callers with Babs in Appleton. Babs, hi.
Hi. Who is that man that you're having on?
That's Ken Mayer from UW-Madison, political scientist.
Oh, okay. Well, I have a different view than what others have been saying. I think that we should preserve voter ID at any cost, because it's very easy now with the Internet and being able to make documents and put your picture on it and have that as voter ID fraud and causing fraud. There's a lot of fraud going on in cities or communities, municipalities that have a college or a university, and I've witnessed it firsthand because I've worked at the polls, at several different polls, and we found it to be rampant in 2004. And so to say that there is no voter fraud in Wisconsin is just ridiculous. There's probably no voter fraud that has gone the distance. You don't know how hard it is to make the case.
All right, Babs, I want to give Ken a chance to respond. Just a minute or so, Ken.
Yeah, I strongly suspect that the types of things the caller is referring to are ambiguities about whether someone is properly registered, whether they have satisfied the conditions that are necessary for residency, or she may view the fact that someone who's a college student who's temporarily residing in Madison or La Crosse or some other place ought not to be able to vote there because they're not a permanent resident. That has nothing to do with voter fraud. That has nothing to do with voter impersonation. The fact is that there is no evidence of systematic voter impersonation, and it simply is not true. And people will insist that they have seen it, that they have heard about it, and invariably it turns out to either be something else or a kind of urban legend that gets repeated and becomes accepted, even though it's not true.
Ken, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Ken Mayer, professor of political science and affiliate faculty member of the La Follette Institute of Public Affairs at UW-Madison, with us to talk about Wisconsin's voter ID law in federal court today.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. It's time now for Wisconsin Life, and this month a look at faith here in Wisconsin. For a community of Benedictine nuns in Dane County, going green isn't just a fad. It has roots dating back 1,500 years.
My name is Sister Mary David Walgenbach. I'm prioress of Holy Wisdom Monastery on the outskirts of Middleton, Wisconsin. We are an ecumenical Benedictine community of sisters. We are open to people of any religious tradition. We're one of the first in North America to have an ecumenical monastery for women. Benedict lived in the 6th century, and he was the first one to write a rule for people living the common life. So a Benedictine means you join a community, you take a promise of stability, you put roots in a place, down in a place, and you stay there. You have a relationship with creation, relationship with the people you live with and the people you serve. So that's where our care for the land comes. Now and forever. I came in 1958, so I've been here a while. The sisters live in a house at the edge of the woods. We have 4 miles of walking trails, and we take walks in the woods so I know where the owls nest. We know where the fox walks. I know where those wild flowers are going to bloom first. Because I've lived on this place for so many years. So now we have 2 buildings. We took down our larger building that was used as a school, and we built a new green building in 2009. We have geothermal. We have solar panels on the roof. This building is pretty much off the grid. We're the biggest user of solar power for Madison Gas and Electric. I've done what I've been called to do. I hope there will be women after me, and we will continue to pass that tradition on of caring for the land. You look at the 1,500-year tradition of Benedictine life in the world. That's what happens. People come, they die at the place, and a new group comes, and it repeats.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more online at wisconsinlife.org.
Joining us now to tell us more about the Holy Wisdom Monastery in Middleton is Sister Lynn Smith, Director of Formation at Holy Wisdom. Sister Lynn, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So how would you describe the overall mission of the Holy Wisdom Monastery?
Oh, we say our mission is weaving prayer, hospitality, justice, and care of the earth into a shared way of life. We, here at the monastery, this is the home of our sisters' community. We also have a number of other ecumenical Benedictine communities around us that participate in this mission with us.
Now, you mentioned care of the earth. Can you tell us more about how that plays out in the grounds there and in your day-to-day lives?
Yes. We have about 115 acres of land that we have restored to native upland prairie. We also have a small 10,000-year-old glacial lake that we dredged in the late 90s. That helps filter water runoff from a local neighborhood to keep the water from going directly into Lake Mendota with its silt and other chemicals. We have large vegetable gardens that we tend that provide our vegetables for the community and also for retreatants throughout the summer. We also have some woods and apple orchards on the property.
Now, the piece also mentioned the solar power capabilities you have. There are also some geothermal settings that you're working with. Can you talk about some of those different projects that involve alternative energy?
Yes. We have 463 solar panels on our couple of buildings at the monastery here. And in 2014, with the addition of those panels, we provide about 60% of the monastery building's energy use. And as Sister Mary David said in her interview, we were Madison Gas and Electric's largest solar customer when we put those solar panels on the building. We also have 39 geothermal wells under our parking lot, and they help provide heating and cooling for our building. We've got the fluid runs through the floors, pipes in the floors, and heats up the floors and in the winter, and that helps keep down heating costs in the winter.
You said that care of the earth is part of your mission. Why do you see it as that in the Benedictine tradition?
Oh, it's because Benedictine communities make a promise of stability. And part of that means we stay together as a community and we stay in one place. And that staying in one place develops a real intimate connection with our local place where we live. And that includes the land as well as the larger community around us. You know, we spend so much time on the land, walking, working in the gardens, working in the prairie, time for reflection, time for prayer there. I found in my own life, it feels like the land is part of our community. I have this really deep and close connection to it. And that's where our caring for it flows from.
So do you feel like the land itself informs or is a partner in some way in your faith?
Oh, I think so, yes. There is some early monk, I'm afraid I don't know the name, who said that there were two books of Revelation. The first book was creation. The second book were scriptures. We can look at creation and learn about the divine, learn about God from all that we see around us, which is a creation of God. So we learn, for instance, God likes diversity. Look at the number of trees and the number of prairie plants and the different variety of birds. It's just a marvel.
We're talking right now with Sister Lynn Smith, Director of Formation at Holy Wisdom Monastery in Middleton. We're learning about the bond between the faith of the Benedictine community there and the land that they are caretakers for. And I wonder, how open is your facility, the Benedictine Monastery, to the public, and how do they come and use it?
Yes. Oh, there are many ways that people can participate with us here. They can come on a personal retreat. They could bring a group and come out on a retreat. We have a worshiping community that's ecumenical that worships together at 9 o'clock on Sunday morning. Anyone is welcome to participate in that. We have a group called Friends of Wisdom Prairie that is especially concerned with working on the land and learning about the land. People can come and participate in those work days, join the group, go on their outings, and participate in their educational events. We have a group called Oblates, who are like associates of the monastery. Those are people who are interested in learning Benedictine spirituality and living it and having support for living it out in their daily lives. Right now, we have an art exhibit from David Giffey, Icons by David Giffey. People can just come out to the monastery building during business hours and view that art.
Well, Sister Lynn, thank you so much for joining us today and telling us about it.
Thank you so much.
That was Sister Lynn Smith, Director of Formation at Holy Wisdom Monastery in Middleton.